we do not know how much time there is. You know, I had a dear friend. In fact, I felt burdened about this and very painful, and still feel it for after the event has happened a few months ago. When I read in the newspaper and heard on the news that a plane had gone down in Manila Bay, it crashed, killing more than half the people. It crashed on takeoff. It was only going a one-hour flight north of Manila. It crashed on takeoff and killed more than half the people on the plane. I read the news and said, there is another accident, more people dead. Until I got an email which said, your good friend has been killed in that crash in Manila. He, his wife, and his son, out of a family of four people, only his daughter is left. I was stunned and shocked for more than one reason. One thing was that I was the one in our student days. He came to me to ask how, well, we met and he asked me, how did I come to the Lord, how to become a Christian? And I led him to the Lord. He was a brilliant student at Cambridge at the time, and we became great friends. He later took his doctorate in physics, and his son was also a doctorate, had also a doctorate in physics. Both were killed. And his wife was also a nurse, and she too was killed. I was stunned by this. I said, Lord, what is this? What is the purpose of this? What is the message? Why did this all happen? I haven't been in touch with him for a very long time. Since I moved off to Canada, we basically were out of touch. At one time, he wanted to serve the Lord, but he never got there. I don't know if one dared to say that had he served the Lord, this thing might not have happened, but that's between him and God. I don't know why, after saying he wanted to serve the Lord, that he didn't. But the point I'm trying to get at is this. Never did he or his family dream that in the space of a few moments, their time on earth was cut short, wiped out. Was gone. He was in good health. His son was only in his 20s, in late 20s, and suddenly it was over. You have a lot of time? Not necessarily. Now, the main message I want to get to you today is precisely because of the shortness of time and the coming of the Lord. What are the indicators of his coming? And what I have to say with the part of the message that I began with will become clear as we go along. Let me read to you a section from Luke chapter 17, verse 26 to 30. Luke chapter 17, verses 26 to 30. And here it speaks about Jesus himself, the Son of Man. And then verse 26 says, just as it was in the days of Noah, so too it will be in the days of the Son of Man. Notice very carefully what is said. As it was in the days of Noah, and I think all of you who have been to Sunday school know the story of Noah, so I don't have to go into detail about Noah. But what was happening in the days of Noah, that will be the same kind of situation that will happen in the days immediately before the coming of the Son of Man, that is of Christ. So what kind of terrible situation was then? Well, actually, when you read it, you don't see anything terrible at all. They were eating and drinking. Yum yum, sik sik, here in Cantonese. Eating and drinking and marrying and being given in marriage. So, what was the problem here? And this sort of thing was going on until the day Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed all these people who are eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage. Can you expound this passage of the Bible to me? And then it goes on and says in verse 28, likewise, just as it was in the days of Lot, that is in the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, they were, what were they doing? They were committing terrible sins, right? Do you see it there? No. What does it say again? They were yum yum sik sik. Pardon my Cantonese. They were eating and drinking, buying and selling. Did you buy something today? Or yesterday? Buying and selling? Dear me. Maybe you don't dare to buy anymore. Planting and building. But on the day that Lot left Sodom, it rained fire and sulfur from heaven and destroyed all of them. It will be like that. It will be like that on the day that the Son of Man appears. Like what? Well, just said so. Did you have lunch today? Ah, so you were eating. Did you have a drink? So you were drinking. It looks like you're in trouble. And what about planting and building? Were you planting something in the garden? Were you building or buying a house of some sort? Somebody else built it for you? I guess most of us don't know how to build houses, so somebody else has to build it. But they build it because you want to buy it. You don't want to buy it, they won't build it. And so it will be. What is the point of all this? Is there something wrong with eating and drinking? I mean, we all be starved if we didn't do that. Do you understand what Jesus is saying? Can you grasp the point? Well, when we look at the passage in Genesis 6, which is the whole story of Noah, the story there is told somewhat differently. So I'm wondering why Jesus told a very well-known story but draws a different point from it. Now, when you read the Bible, you have to be very discerning and watchful to see whether you understand not just the words there. We all understand what eating and drinking means, but we don't understand it on the spiritual level. What is Jesus trying to say? Surely he is not saying no one should eat and no one should drink. And if that is not his point, what is his point? Well, when we look at Genesis, especially, say, verse 11, it says, the earth was corrupt before God. And the earth was filled with violence. Strange that Jesus makes no reference to that at all at this point. He does say something about that in Matthew 24, but he says nothing of that here. And of course, it's a matter of historical fact that the 20th century has indeed been a time filled with violence. And it looks like we're going to have violence very soon again, according to the news. Wars and rumors of wars seem to be the order of the day. But that does not seem to be the main thing. And then in the next verse, in Genesis 6:5, it says, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thought of his heart was only evil continually. Well, that seems to give us the impression that they were committing all kinds of horrendous sins, but not one of them is named. We don't know what are these evil thoughts that filled their hearts and minds. And then Genesis chapter 3, verse 6 says, and my spirit shall not strive with man forever. Now, let us understand this thing, because it has to do with my first point, the awareness of God. The capacity to know God, to sense his presence. That is the point. You see, we make a fundamental mistake in thinking that the reason why that generation in Noah's time was wiped out was because they did every manner of evil, such as nobody else ever did. Well, if that were the case, it was time to have destroyed the whole human race and brought on another destruction after the Second World War or during it, where 6 million Jews were gassed to death, or put to death in various ways, another 4 million non-Jews, including Christians, were killed by the Nazis. 10 million people exterminated. Now, how much evil do you have to tolerate before God acts? If we want to talk in terms of killings and bombings, what about the First World War, when they used mustard gas and other kinds of gases, chlorine gas and whatever, to gas everybody to death, and those who didn't die were blinded and so forth? You know those stories. How many million died on the fields of Europe in the First World War? That was not enough for God to intervene. We had a Second World War in which many more millions died, and we wouldn't talk about how many died in China alone. Tens of millions, countless millions died. How much more violence do we have to wait for? And what has become somewhat of a famous phrase of President Bush, how long do we have to wait? Well, I don't think we have long to wait, but the point is, you see, our understanding of sin is always in terms of murder, robbery, rape, and so forth. That is sin to us. Let me tell you, God is concerned about something much worse than that. You said something worse than that? Yes. Yum, yum, sick, sick. What? That's worse? You know why? You see, the point here that we must understand is not that the eating and drinking in itself is the problem. What we must understand is what God hates is the kind of life that is simply preoccupied with the things of this world. This eating and drinking, this marrying and giving in marriage themselves, there's nothing wrong with those things. But there is something wrong when these things exclude God from your life. God is pushed aside because you're more busy eating and drinking, buying food, planting food, looking for the best. You're more busy with your marrying and getting married. Your focus of attention is on yourself. You didn't get married just for somebody else. You got married for yourself. Everything, eating, drinking, everything is me, mine, all this self-centered stuff. And the church and the world is filled with self-centeredness. That is the whole problem. You see, that is what Jesus wanted to tell us. Don't think that Jesus comes, that I will come again, just because there's violence on the earth. There will be violence, because self-centeredness will produce violence. It will produce war. It will produce gassings and chemical warfare and biological warfare and nuclear war, whatever. Man, in his self-centeredness, does all of these kind of things. So violence is not the root cause. It is a symptom of something deeper. It is a symptom in which you live your life, or the world lives its life. We all live our lives for ourselves. Self-centeredness is the sin. And if you don't understand that, of course, you can't see why did Jesus say that? He is saying that man is becoming ever more self-centered. And the result is that when it reaches a stage that only God knows enough is enough, with all this self-centeredness, he will come suddenly in the hour you don't expect. Now, the problem with self-centeredness is that it can be masked to look like something pretty good. It looks nice. Who doesn't like to be at a wedding? Everybody's happy. Everybody sings. Everybody has more eating and drinking and more buying and selling. And it goes on and on in an ever-increasing, widening circle. What you and I need to be saved from is this self-centeredness. Pardon me for saying so, but sometimes when I listen to sharings and things, it seems all so unbelievably self-centered. It's all me and my this and me this and that. When is God the center of our lives? Now, in the time of Noah, as in the days of Noah, why was Noah saved and the others were not? Why was Noah allowed to go into the ark with his family, the others were not? Well, the answer is given very simply there. And Noah, they say in Genesis 6, Noah walked with God. That is the thing about Noah. That's what made him different. He walked with God. Anybody here walking with God? I didn't say, did you believe in God? I'm sure if I asked you to raise your hands who believe in God, a lot of hands will go up. I said, is anybody walking with God? Do you even know what it means to walk with God? We know that Enoch walked with God, and he was caught up, raptured. You know, the end time rapture is not a new thing. There's a lot of rapture been going on in the Bible. It went on from Genesis. Enoch got raptured. Elijah got raptured. There's lots of rapturing going on. The effect, the result of walking with God can be very dramatic. What is it to walk with God? What is the first and primary condition? You will not taste God. You will not hear God. You will not experience God until when? Until there is such a fundamental, radical change at the root of your life, where there is no more I. Did I say no more I? I said yes, no more I. Now that is achieved, if I can put it this way, through the power of the Spirit in very, very few people. And that is why there are so few people who experience God. I know God is in this room. I know His presence. Do you? All the time, it is my life habit of communing with Him and listening to Him. Even what I'm saying to you now, I don't say because I put this all together for this message. There's many a time that I prepared a message and the Lord said, scrap it. I have something else I want you to say. And I've scrapped part of this message because as I'm listening, I'm changing the message. I'm doing what He wants me to do. But in order to be able to do this, I have to be able to hear. I have to be able to listen. And you learn to listen when you walk with God. The thing that disturbs me enormously, after all these years of teaching the Word of God and teaching people in the full-time training, is that whether in the church or even among those in full-time training, let me be very frank and honest about this, there are not many who have learned to walk with God. And the reason for that is because it's very difficult to walk with God, right? Why? Because we cannot get rid of the I. You talk to people, and what do they talk about? It's I, me, my, always. The whole life, the thinking goes round and around about that self, that ego. No wonder the psychologists see that the ego is the center of man. They have recognized that long ago. You want to handle a human being, you start with his ego or ego, whichever way you like to pronounce it. And that is the very thing that cuts you off from God. That is why Paul said, I am crucified with Christ. I now no longer live. The I is gone. Not I, but Christ lives in me. Not I. How many times have you heard that verse? But have you ever implemented it? If we read the Bible and talk about it and we don't implement it, what does that make us? That makes us hypocrites, isn't it? And how can we blame people when they say the church is full of hypocrites? Who know how to talk and don't know how to live. As long as that I is still dominant in me, the consequence is I can't commune with God. So whenever the I in me starts acting up, my communication with God is cut off immediately. It's gone. I can pray as hard as I like. I can plead. I can do whatever. No use. God is not going to listen to me. Not until this big I in me, the 自我, is dealt with. So I'm telling you something which is very practical. You either practice it or you don't. Never say that you don't know after today's message how to walk with God. The first step is a long way. Walking is a matter of distance, and we'd have to develop this some other time. But the first step, and all we have time for today, is the first step. And that is, that self has to go. And then you find that the barrier of communing with God is gone. Otherwise, your praying is going to be what? It's going to be a religious exercise. You take the prayer book and you sit and pray, 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 and you pray fervently. What is fervently? Fervently means try to put a bit of emotion in there. I'm sometimes very worried when people say, oh, everybody looks miserable. Why don't you stand up and put a smile on your face? Well, how do you do this? I can smile if I don't have the joy inside. I have to have joy before I can smile. We can't act it out. And one thing more, of course, is that we cannot get rid of the I in our own strength. It's not as though I can crucify myself. Have you tried crucifying yourself? You can't do that. You might manage to put the nail in one hand. Oh, how do you get the other hand? You've got one hand crucified here. Maybe we have a lot of one-hand crucified people who mean well because they try to kill themselves with their own effort. This is not something we can do with our own effort. That is the reason why we cannot save ourselves. Can't be done. We can't crucify ourselves. So what happens is we have to let the Holy Spirit deal with this I in us. Are you willing to let that happen? That is a big question. And once you're willing to let that happen, when you said, Lord, here I am, you crucify me with Christ, then I can say, I am crucified with Christ. Now I no longer live. Ah, what freedom. Have you ever known the freedom from self? I'm afraid few people do. Just to be free of yourself. Ah, that great burden is gone. The thing that gave you all your illusions, the thing that gave you false desires, pursuing after the wind, this kind of stuff. When God comes, He sets you free. When the Son of Man, when He sets you free, you are free indeed. So many people in bondage to their emotions. I see many Christians, you know, this weather in Melbourne is remarkable. For those of us who visit here, and this is my third time here, it is a mystery, this weather. You know, one moment is sunshine, a little later it's cloudy, the next moment is downpouring with rain, after that the sun is out again, and it goes on and on like this through the whole day. I thought, what kind of weather is this? But then, you know, we know Christians, so-called Christians, who are like that, isn't it? One moment they're shining, happy, and next moment they're so down. And you say, you know, what happened now? And the next moment the tears are pouring down their face, and after that they're smiling again. Oh, that's a real mystery. I might have to call them the Melbourne Christian, Melbourne type Christian, Melbourne weather Christian. Very unique. But that is what happens when you are controlled by your emotions. You're blown this way and that way. And nowadays they talk about emotional intelligence or something. Well, whatever that is. The problem is that emotion is what drives you up and down, left and right, and all in all kinds of circles. To be free from all of this, that is a great part of freedom. Apart from the freedom of the sin, the root of all sin, selfishness. The I, the self. So to talk about sin and the need to deal with sin will forever be utter superficiality until we get to the root of the whole business. And you know, when you have the self, the most deceptive thing is that you can look very righteous, you can behave in the most religious manner, you can be kneeling on your knees and practicing religion, and you don't know God. My professor at the university when I was doing theology, we call it in England divinity. I'm not quite sure why it's called divinity there. I guess it's the study of God. But anyway, I remember one day this professor, because we were one-on-one talking with each other, and we were studying a passage in the Old Testament, and then he looked up at me, a man of 60-some years, a great scholar, a person who has published probably dozens of books and learned articles and everything, known throughout England as a foremost Old Testament theologian. He looked up at me and said, you know, after all, there may be a God. And I nearly fell off the chair. Maybe a God? And you're a professor of Old Testament? What are you doing here? An ordained minister of the Church of England? A professor of theology? What are we talking here? Well, this is my point, you see. He knows the Bible inside out. I think it wouldn't be false to say that he really literally knows it through and through. He's written countless articles on this, and books and books. Some time ago, out of sentimentality, I was somewhere in the United States and I saw a copy of his book on sale. And I thought, well, I used to be his student. I don't even have one of his books, so maybe out of sentimentality I'll buy a copy, just for old time's sake, as it were. But here is a man who spent his whole life studying the Bible, and he doesn't know God. Can it be that you have been reading the Bible since Sunday school days, and you think you know God? At least he was honest. That I appreciated. That after all that reading, the knowledge was in the head, it was not in the heart. Going to church all your life is not going to save you. And reading the Bible all your life is not going to save you either. You've got to put that into practice, which he never did, obviously. And therefore, he did not know God. Do not think that Old Testament professors or New Testament professors or theologians know God. They know about God. It doesn't mean they know him personally. And that is my constant fear. That you may be in this church and you don't know God. And you don't even know how to know him. But I have told you today, and I don't know whether you can face the challenge. The challenge will be too much for most people. I wonder whether that was the reason, my dear friend, who, this doctor of physics, the price was too high in the end. He could make some kind of commitment to God, but the I was too strong. And instead of going forth to serve the Lord as he thought himself to be called to do, he didn't go in the end. The cost was too high. Cost means the self cannot pay the cost. Price is a price that challenges the survival of the self, the I. Can you handle it? No, you can't. Not without the power of God and the grace of God. But if you are willing to put that aside, marvelous things will begin to happen. Otherwise, frankly, the Christian life is not worth living. It's going to be the boring routine of eating and drinking, of buying and selling, of marrying and giving in marriage, which is very exciting for a while until afterwards. Sorry, I'm frank again. After all, I'm a pastor, and I have to deal with failing marriages and marriage tensions and marriage problems, and on it goes. It's wonderful at the time. How long does it last? And after that, for face-saving reasons, especially among Chinese people, even if the marriage is not working, you have to smile a little bit in public, you know. And when you go home, then the real thing starts. And too bad for the children. The root, let me stress again, of all problems, including the incapacity to commune with God, to walk with him, is the I. If that is not finished, if that is not dealt with, you will never be free. Let me close. I think the time is about gone. I just want to say something on the positive side, that if you do let God take away the I from your life, that selfishness, that egocentricity, the only concern is how do I live? I don't care about all those people in China perishing. That will be a sure sign that the I is dominant in your life. You don't care. You don't care about anybody else. You don't care where they perish. You say you believe that anyone who has Jesus has eternal life. You believe it? I might say, no, I don't think you believe it. Why do I say that? If you believed it enough, then does it not concern you that 1.3 billion people of our fellow countrymen, Guru Zichim, are perishing? You care? How is this job going to be done? How is it going to be fulfilled? Do you know? Take a little pen and paper or use your computer. Just do a simple calculation. If we were to try to reach 1.3 billion people in the space of 4 years, say by 2007, in which in that time already 80 or 90 or 100 million Chinese people already have died anyway in that space of time, but the remaining ones. And the young ones are too small for you to reach. Make a simple calculation. How many people, if there were 1 million Christians available, 1 million, which is an exaggerated figure, 1 million Chinese Christians to reach 1.3 billion, how many people would each person have to reach in that 4 year period? Each person will have to reach 1,300 people within 4 years. Now, let me ask you, if you say that you're a good Christian, how many people have you saved? How long have you been a Christian? Have you been a Christian for 5 years? And just say 5 years. How many people have you led to the Lord, you witnessed to the Lord in 5 years? 10? 20? How would you be able to reach 1,300 people in 4 years' time? How is this job going to be done? But the job can never be done, not just because the figures are impossible, because God can accomplish anything, but because the eye will stop the progress of the gospel. The greatest hindrance is ourselves. It blinds us to the reality. It blinds us to the presence of God. It cuts off our communion with Him. It prevents us from walking with Him. I want to close now with with what happens when one is prepared to take the course and go forward. Like this girl, plunge into the deep and save the perishing. I told in Sydney the story, but I never finished the ending of it. I told the first part of the story of an American brother who went out to bring the gospel to the Muslims in East Africa. He had done his PhD in theology in some college in the United States. He could have stayed home with his wife and two children, and he could have got a teaching post perhaps in some college or seminary and lived, you know, serving the Lord. You know, he's still serving the Lord, teaching other people. But what he chose was the more difficult path. He chose to take himself and his family to a third world country, and worst of all, a Muslim country, worst of all from the Christian point of view, because Muslims are very resistant, have never shown any sign of being open to the gospel. And he went to this Muslim country, and he tried to preach the gospel, and nobody would listen to him, of course. In fact, quite a few people spat at him. That's one of the acts of contempt that the Muslim will show to the Christian. If you talk about Christianity, they spit in your face. Why did he have come all this way to be spat upon when he could have had some honor and glory in his own country and still be said to be serving the Lord and teaching the Bible? But his heart burned for these people and he wanted to get the gospel to them. Nobody wanted to listen, and one day he was so desperate that he stood on a bridge in the center of the city and said, "You people don't listen to me about Jesus, I'm going to jump into the river." Moved by concern, compassion, fire. So this guy is crazy. That's what he wanted to be, crazy for the Lord. And you know, that stopped the people. That stopped the traffic. There was this Westerner standing on this bridge, threatening to jump off, so they stopped and listened to him. And then he preached Christ to them. And when he had finished, he jumped into the river. Just to show that it was no empty threat. He was willing to jump into that foul, dirty river for the sake of Christ. And then people began to listen. Some of them still spat at him. At one occasion, very touchingly, he witnessed to a beggar sitting by the roadside who had no legs. He was sitting there begging for food, begging for money. And he sat down beside this beggar to witness to him. And the beggar spat at him too. And yet he would not give up. The love of Christ was such that he continued talking to this beggar day after day after day, for several weeks. And at first the beggar continued to show contempt, but gradually he changed. And in the end, with tears running down his face, he lay on the ground. He could not kneel because he had no legs. He lay with his face to the ground, as Muslims do, and gave his life to the Lord. So a beggar was transformed, and this beggar then went back to his hometown to witness to others, and they said, "They are going to kill you." He said, "Well, that's all right, let them kill me. I'm going to come back and witness anyway." And through this converted beggar that nobody cared two hoots about, a large part of his town came to know the Lord. At first, of course, he was rejected, beaten, thrown out, whatever. He took it all. He said, "If Christ could love me to this extent, that this man is willing to sit beside me, you know, for several weeks sharing the gospel with me, what kind of love is this? This kind of love I must share to others too." It's selflessness. You see, love, true love is selflessness. In the world, love is possessive. I want to take hold of somebody else. It's called love, loving that person. In scripture, love and God's love is entirely different. It is not my taking possession of somebody, that she is mine or he is mine. It is I giving myself to somebody. And this American missionary, if you like to call him, gave himself to a beggar until that beggar was won. Then the head of the mosque heard about all this and challenged him to open debate in the mosque, thinking that this gospel is spreading, is dangerous, I better crush it, nip it in the bud, as they say, and invited him to the mosque to debate publicly with him. And of course the mosque was packed full to listen to this debate of their imam, their spiritual leader, against this American preacher. And then, in the midst of all this debate going on, there came a man with a little child in his arm and walked up to him and said, "Sir, my little girl, who's 3 years old or so, she's crippled, she cannot walk. She's born crippled. I've heard a lot about this debate going on about Jesus and Islam. Can your Jesus heal my little girl?" Wow, that was a challenge. I mean, he studied theology, but healing was not his department. He could have said, "Excuse me, but let me go and get a healer from somewhere." But the crowd was looking intently and watching. You know, in Islam, they believe in Jesus. They believe that Jesus did heal the sick and raise the dead. That's in the Quran. That's why this man brought the child, not as an act of contempt, but because the Quran said that Jesus does heal. So he wanted to see, is Jesus really the person that the Quran says was the one who could even raise the dead? Wow, he felt trapped now. And all the eyes of the people in the mosque were looking at him. Is your Jesus real, or are you just talking? And he cried out to the Lord and said, "Lord, I've never faced this situation before, but your name is now, you know, at stake. What to do?" And so he prayed for this little girl, and nothing happened. And his heart sank. He said, "Lord, after this, no talk will be of any use at all. It's finished. He might as well just slink out of the mosque. So the father looked at his child and saw that she was crippled as before. Nothing happened. Then he said, "Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe this particular request was too difficult for Jesus. Jesus could not deal with this kind of a problem. I'm sorry, I've embarrassed you." And he turned around and he took his little girl away and walked out towards the door. And he watched the father and the little girl, whose head was over the shoulder of the father, looking back at him. So two big eyes looking at him as they were walking away. And then the little girl began to push the father away, and he was holding her and wondered, what's she doing? And kept pushing him more and more forcefully, as it were telling him, "Put me down, you know, let me go." So the father, being rather puzzled by this, put the girl down, and behold, the girl stood on her feet and walked. And the whole mosque, there was a gasp that went up. So Jesus is real. Jesus is real. This little girl was walking around happily, who had never walked in her life. Would you dare to face the challenge? Here was a man who was able to see the wonder of God, experience his presence and his power. Because why? He had put away the I. He had put away the self. No more I. No more my comfort, my plans. I offer my plan to God. "Lord, you bless my plan. I'm going to teach in this seminary. Lord, bless my plan. I want to teach there. Please give me the best job in the seminary." That is I. He said, "Not me, Lord. What do you, not what I want, Lord. What do you want me to do?" And the Lord said, "Africa." Africa? How many of you would like to go to Africa? I don't think any of you would like to go to Africa. I think Africa is probably one of the last places that any of us want to go to, right? Especially to those third world countries. But he said, "Lord, where you want me to go, I go." To Africa? Fine. And what about the family? All go together. He paid a terrible price for his willingness to put away the self and do God's will only. And you know what was the price? Not jumping into the river, not going to Africa. That part I didn't mention in Sydney. He lost his wife. His dear wife was so close to him. That was the price. Could he take it? I heard him on tape. I listened to this firsthand, listening to him telling this account. And he gloried in what God was doing until it came to the part where he told how he and his wife went to fetch their two children who were going to a school in another town. And when they were coming back in this jeep, they were ambushed by Muslims who were very angry at the fact that thousands of Muslims were turning to the Lord. He had brought the gospel and he had brought life to thousands. And the Muslims were angry, very, very angry. And so as he was driving back at night, they opened up with their machine guns, AK-47s, whatever it was they used, and fired up on the car. The children ducked down. He jumped out of the car, and the attackers left after spraying the car with bullets. He came back, and he found his wife dying. And he took his wife in his arms, and she died in his arms. And at that point, I can see how much it hurt him, because he broke down and couldn't speak any further. So, walking with Jesus is wonderful, but costly. Could you take that price? Can you take the cost? Would you be willing to accept that going there would mean perhaps the end of the family as he knew it? And the most painful part, of course, was that he watched his wife die in his arms, and she said to him, "Don't ever turn away from the path that the Lord has set for us and for you. Be faithful to him to the end." What a wonderful couple. No I, no self, just the Lord. This earthly life will pass anyway, but they will have eternal life. And what will be their union in the presence of God? So today I've told you, then shared with you the secret of this matter of really meeting with God, experiencing him, walking with him. And as a result of that life, thousands are drawn to the Lord. But you may have to pay a price. Let us close in prayer.